Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Axler, and Mary Craig. Although there weren't many games played due to the All-Star break, it was still an action-packed week. The All-Star game itself was somewhat overshadowed by the uncovering of some rather disturbing tweets by Milwaukee Brewers pitcher Josh Hader, a subject we will discuss at length later in this episode. First, though, let's do a quick rundown of the Home Run Derby and the All-Star Game. On Monday, Bryce Harper became the Home Run Derby champion, defeating Kyle Schwarber in the final round to earn the title. On Tuesday, the American League defeated the National League in 10 innings, 8-6, and the two squads combined for a record-setting 10 home runs. Alex Bregman was named the game's MVP for his tie-breaking home run in the 10th inning off Ross Stripling. So what were some of our personal favorite moments from the Derby and the All-Star game?
I think I'm going to start out and just go broad and say anytime you saw the player showing their personality, it really seemed like for both the Derby and the All-Star game, the players were excited to be there. They were excited to play themselves and to watch some of the greatest players in the game at this moment play. So that was really exciting to see. In terms of like individual moments, Luis Severino catching Aaron Judge's home run off of Max Scherzer was a hilarious moment. And also Max Scherzer and Chris Sale both coming out and throwing their hardest pitches of the season, and just how kind of amped up they were to be starting the game against each other for the second year in a row. And then also everything Francisco Lindor did during the All-Star game, from, you know, dropping to give push-ups after he failed to hit a home run in his first at-bat in the sixth inning, to whenever he was mic'd up on the field. He was just kind of out there loving life, and it was really nice and hilarious to see.
Yeah, I know that this has been talked about a lot, but it really can't be overstated how great the changes that have been made to the All-Star game in the past 2 years have been. You know, now that it's really just an exhibition game that doesn't count for anything, and they can kind of goof around and, you know, not take it super seriously. And, you know, you have players out there getting mic'd up while they're on the field or taking selfies on the field. It's just, it's a very different dynamic and very much for the better. I mean, like you said, Mary, you get to see players' personalities. And I, for one, learned that Charlie Blackman has a personality. I never would have guessed. I was watching his on-field interview and I was like, oh my God, I think I like Charlie Blackman. I would have had no idea. And I'm sure people who, you know, follow the Rockies more closely knew that all along, but that's the thing. You know, you get to know your own team really well, and you don't necessarily get the chance to know anyone besides like the really big name players. And, you know, Blackman is someone who's getting up there, but he's maybe not quite there yet. And, you know, now I know, I'm like, hey, you are a fun dude. I enjoy you, even though that haircut's still inexcusable. just taking it back to the Derby, I just want to give a shout out to my boy Max Muncy for making it past the first round. You know, I think that's really all people wanted to see. Obviously him winning the whole thing would have been incredible, but I don't think anyone actually thought that was going to happen. And he, you know, went up against Bryce Harper in the second round. So clearly it was not meant to be, but yeah, he beat Javi Baez. I don't think anybody saw that coming. So, I'm excited about that. It was kind of the big Dodger moments of the, thing of the whole, festivities, but, it was a good moment.
Can we talk about Bryce Harper's dad for a moment?
His super jacked dad? Yeah. Oh my God, he's terrifying.
He really is. Like, he is. He stepped on the field and I was just like, oh my God. And he's apparently done like competitions, like tire flipping stuff. And like, he's, you know, super into fitness. And it's kind of terrifying. And also, he should maybe stop just fermenting his beard so much. But I guess that adds to the terrifying look. It seems like that's what he's going for.
Yes. I remember a while back, Grant Brisby tweeted about how he wondered if Marcus Stroman's dad could beat up Bryce Harper's dad. And if you guys haven't seen Marcus Stroman's dad, he is just as frighteningly jacked as Bryce Harper's dad is. I don't know what, just go Google it. It's, they're like, yeah, it's just like, what's the deal with all these super buff baseball dads? It's a weird trend that, I mean, by trend, I mean, there's like two of them, but
it's a huge trend.
Two of them for now.
For now.
Yeah. If they keep getting this much publicity, who knows how many there will be.
So I unfortunately was not able to watch the All-Star game because I was working my day job until like 7:30 p.m. Pacific. So I missed most of it, but I did see the home run derby, and Bryce Harper basically just going on video game mode like the last 47 seconds of the final round before he had extra time. That was my favorite moment because it was like, oh my God, Bryce Harper is not human, which probably also explains his dad a little bit. They're both not human. I also wanted to say that I did know Charlie Blackman had a personality, but of course I do follow the Rockies pretty closely.
Fine.
Wow, way to brag.
Like there's a tweet somewhere, like one of the Rockies players got stranded on the freeway, and then I think it was Blackman who just came with like a canister of gas, and it was like all the way in the off season, and like tweeted a picture of like Blackman filling the car.
All right, so not only does he have a personality, he also sounds like a pretty righteous dude. Helps you out when you're in trouble.
Yeah. So I might be mixing it up. No, it was Blackman who came, yeah, with the gas. So he has a pretty good personality about things. But the fact that, you know, on a national level, obviously, like, the Rockies aren't going to get this much publicity because they are the Rockies, you know, even though they are now second place in the NL West. Teams like the Rockies and then other teams that don't get as much national coverage get to be on this national stage, and it's, you know, really, really good to actually see that kind of stuff because, you know, we hear so much about, like, Mike Trout, Clayton Kershaw, Aaron Judge, you know, Buster Posey, but we don't hear about guys like Charlie Blackman, so just good to be able to see, like, other dudes in the league having fun and they're not, like, in pinstripes. So,
speaking of Mike Trout, I just want to mention he now has hits in 6 straight All-Star games.
Yes, so. Which is so Mike Trout.
Very.
He's a very on-brand kind of guy, which we'll also kind of get to later in the episode.
Yeah, and I guess the other cool thing about this is that about the All-Star game is that both final vote winners, Jesus Aguilar and Jean Segura, they both homered. And they were pretty impactful homers, so it was kind of cool to see them making their mark on the game after getting in on the sort of last hail effort there.
Yeah, they certainly made a count and made it, you know, worthwhile for all of the fans who spent their time voting for the two players. So that was definitely cool to see, and it certainly added a lot of excitement to the game in those final few innings.
Definitely, yeah, I totally agree. I think it's cool that, you know, not only do the final vote winners, you know, they made it into the game because in, you know, past years there were moments where, you know, final vote winners didn't make it in and they were just off the bench and was only in, like, extra inning scenarios. But the fact that they both made it in the game and made an impact on the game is pretty awesome to see.
Unfortunately, what ended up being the most memorable thing about the All-Star game was the resurfacing of Josh Hader's racist, homophobic, and misogynistic tweets from years past. In case you haven't heard, Hader had tweets from 2011 and 2012, when he would have been 17 and 18. Among the most alarming content was a plethora of N-words, a tweet saying white power, one that simply read KKK, a tweet declaring I hate gay people, and several graphic tweets objectifying women. He received no suspension or fine, but will have to undergo sensitivity training and participate in diversity and inclusion initiatives, which began a couple of days ago when he met with Billy Beane. because apparently Hader is the victim in all of this. He received a standing ovation when he entered to pitch in Saturday's Brewers game, his first appearance since the tweets were uncovered. So, this begs the question, why is this not something players have to undergo in the first place? And why on earth do players not cleanse their social media accounts before they're drafted?
So, I still wonder why they, like, sensitivity training is not mandatory in baseball. That's still something that I've been championing for, because I feel like it's something that shouldn't be seen as a punishment. It should be seen as, okay, this will make you not only a better person, but also not get you in trouble. And at that point, when, you know, if all players in the league go through sensitivity training and they still, you know, screw up, then, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, we already did something about it. We just have to do better. And also sets this precedent for people like, hey, don't screw up because you've already received sensitivity training. The next thing, you know, that might happen, will probably, you know, you probably get suspended more likely considering you did not listen to sensitivity training. As for social media accounts, 2011 and 2012 was still kind of like, it still feels like the earlier years of social media, and like cleansing the accounts, like they didn't have those like automatic tweet deleting websites back then. Like you could only do it manually, and even then, like you'd have to delete like every single tweet. That being said, I mean, he could have locked his account. He could have deleted everything starting now that, you know, it's 2018 and that technology exists, but they're not consulted with a lot of these things, especially like high school draftees. You know, if they had an agent, they would be told like, hey, clean your social media account. But that also goes into, well, you know, you consult an agent about what to do when you're drafted. You might lose your NCAA eligibility if you, you know, if you talk to someone, and like if you end up not, you end up being drafted but decide to go to college anyway, like do you go to college because you talk to an agent who advise you to clean your social media account? And it gets into a very, very tricky situation there, because a lot of high school ball players might not know, like, hey, don't be that person online. And it's not inherent to them, because like social media has basically been their entire youth. So I think that's another concern. And, you know, I mean, it's also another thing that coaches should learn, especially like in high school. And college ball players do receive a little bit more media training, especially if they're D1 players and if they're at one of the Power 5 schools. It's just players who don't have that privilege of going to D1 Power 5 conference school, they don't have as many resources. And I'm thinking that it's going to be a big thing now, like with the recent draftees, and there were a lot of draftees whose old tweets were found. Like, I think next year, most draftees will probably start cleaning their social media accounts before being drafted, because I think it was like the Rockies first round pick who had a couple of questionable things tweeted out. So I think it's just going to change things moving forward. And I think teams will also start paying attention to it more. Like, if they can dig up X, Y, and Z, it's like it's part of a person's makeup. In scouting lingo, it's part of their character. So there's a lot of reasons, and I think I just went off on a whole different thing there. But I think it's all relevant. Like, they don't have the access to it, but, you know, it's something that will probably change starting with the next draft class.
Yeah, we've obviously talked in the past about bad tweets of all kinds of natures coming up. But I think this hater incident may actually be a turning point. And it's possible it's just like, I mean, I would have to say that with hater, these are the worst that I've ever seen, both in terms of the magnitude of how many bad tweets there were, but also just the content of the tweets. And maybe that'll find, like, it seems like it's gotten more people's attention than the sort of thing usually does. So I'm hoping that this will actually prevent things from happening like this in the future. And that'll lead to people being more aware, both of the fact that you can't be putting this stuff out there and the fact that you shouldn't be saying these things or feeling these things, because they're, it's, you know, both are unacceptable. But yeah, I agree that, you know, there may not be the knowledge or awareness, or at least there may not have been, that this is something that you can or should do. Even though, like, I think for us who spend a lot of time online, it seems really obvious, like, oh yeah, I can just search, you know, from my name and, you know, certain terms and, like, dig up old tweets and, you know, find things that you might want to remove. But, you know, maybe that's not the case for the average ball player who's, you know, just coming up, which in that case, it kind of is wild to me that teams aren't doing this at the, you know, this far along in the game. Like, it seems like it would be so easy for, you know, just the PR department of a team to, like, have a list of, like, all their players, just search everyone they're following for, you know, various unacceptable terms and words that are, they may have used in the past, and just be like, hey, you gotta delete this. And I mean, I have mixed feelings about even that approach, because, you know, that doesn't mean that they are, it means they still are employing people who have, you know, done and said these terrible things, but at least, you know, it prevents them from doing further damage by letting them be uncovered for everyone to see. So I guess that's better than just letting them sit out there forever until, you know, someone dredges them up as a way to bring them down. But yeah, it does seem like it's a thing that will become more commonplace now to see these things getting, or not necessarily see, because I think it'll happen more behind the scenes, but I think it will be less common now to have this old stuff kind of brought to light. I think there's a lot more awareness now. And as for what we were saying earlier about the issue of sensitivity training, I think that if it was something that was being done as a preventative measure, then people wouldn't see it as a punishment. And I think that's the issue with what's going on with Josh Hader right now. People think, oh, he quote unquote apologized, sort of, not really. And he is undergoing sensitivity training, and that qualifies as punishment. So he's paid his dues, but it's not really that. He hasn't actually suffered in any way. He's just said some inappropriate stuff and is now being trained how to not do that going forward. And if it were something that, again, everyone had to undergo and everyone had to do, no one would think of that as a sufficient punishment or a sufficient way of atoning for what he did. So that's, yeah, that's definitely something that needs to change going forward, needs to be treated as something preventative rather than punitive.
Mm-hmm. So how would we like to have seen the league handle haters' bigoted tweets?
It's a tricky subject, admittedly, because, I mean, is there a statute of limitations on this sort of thing? I don't know. I mean, I don't really think there should be necessarily, because the fact of the matter is this guy was, you know, it would have been around the time when he was coming up, that he was saying this stuff, and he was out there in professional baseball with the stuff up on his profile. So I don't know. I don't necessarily think there should be a statute of limitations on this. I guess I can see where other people are coming from when they say that, but I think that he left it out there. I think that is worthy of some sort of actual punishment. You know, we've seen players get suspended for far less severe infractions. So I think some sort of suspension would have at least sent a message that it's not something that is tolerated. But the fact that he really did not receive a suspension because, you know, like we've said, we don't really consider the sensitivity training to be a punishment. He really has not received any of that. And I guess we don't know the full details of what goes into sensitivity training. As you mentioned, Mary, it's, he's met with Billy Bean. And while I think that's a step in the right direction, because obviously Billy Bean being the only living gay out of the closet ball player who made it to the majors, he is in some ways kind of uniquely qualified to have discussions of homophobia, with another ball player, but that alone is not going to be enough. The homophobia was obviously just one part of it. And, we don't know exactly what they're doing to deal with the racism aspect of it. So it's a little bit harder to comment on, what actually is going on in the sensitivity training. But of what we know, that alone isn't going to do the job. So hopefully it's going a lot more in depth than that.
Yeah, and going off that a little bit, I feel like there's just a lot of things that the league could have done even more in addition to what they're doing. I feel like it sets a bad precedent to consider sensitivity training as punishment when it's, rather personal enrichment of, awareness. And I think that Clinton Yates of The Undefeated had a good series of tweets about this and a good article about this as well that I encourage everyone to read from his standpoint as a Black sports writer who did play baseball as a youth, that these tweets did happen before he joined the Players Association, and there is some kind of precedent there that I'm sure that the union doesn't want to set, like, well, these tweets happened before he was member of the union, but it still stands that he still left these tweets up as a member of the union, and there was a debate over whether or not it was within the understanding that is this something that the league should penalize because this was before he was in professional baseball. So it was a really interesting discussion, and there were really interesting points raised. But it all boiled down to, well, he still had the tweets up as a professional ball player who represents Major League Baseball and, represented the National League as an all-star. That not only reflects terribly on Hader, but also the league itself. And I would have liked to have seen Hader at least fined with the money going to Little League teams in underserved areas. Maybe have him do some work with the RBI Academy. But at the same time, it's like, okay, are these just photo ops or is he actually putting the work in? And of course, that's something that we can't control, but I feel like there was just so many different things that could have helped the situation out more. And I think it's important to point out that I saw a tweet about this. I don't remember who tweeted it, but a ball player in the minor leagues gets 50 games if they are suspended for smoking cannabis, whereas a player who's racist, homophobic and misogynistic tweets are found and they're not suspended any games at all. So just to put that into perspective a little bit.
Yeah, this certainly does not reflect well on Major League Baseball or the Milwaukee Brewers organization. They've done a lot to minimize the situation or to make Hader seem like he's received a greater punishment that he has, that he's actually, the victim in the situation. And we've seen those things parroted by a lot of large national media writers, which is not great. And there just doesn't seem to be enough done to help the victims of Hader's bigoted tweets. They seem to be neglected in this situation entirely. And so it would be great if Major League Baseball could do something, you know, maybe specifically, you know, punish Hader in some way or have some sort of larger action taken to let, you know, marginalized individuals know that Major League Baseball does want them to feel safe in ballparks, does want them to feel included in, you know, the process of watching baseball and how baseball is crafted. And how players understand marginalized people's roles in baseball at all these different levels, you know, but all of that has been neglected, which is really frustrating and, you know, sad to see. And I know that a lot of people are feeling like they don't belong in baseball, you know, and obviously that's a common feeling, you know, whenever these sorts of things crop up. But it's just time for Major League Baseball to kind of take a step back, to evaluate things in terms of the actual victims of haters' tweets, as opposed to just trying to make this sort of PR nightmare disappear as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and another thing that I think is relevant, I was interviewing people for a piece that just kind of stalled, unfortunately. It was going to be about the history of Pride Nights in Major League Baseball. I talked to a trans person who told me his friends constantly ask him, like, well, why do you like sports so much when it doesn't like you? And he said that when they started having Pride Nights for his local team, like, he felt it was like the one game where he would feel accepted to be there and felt safe to be there. And I think that's an important thing that Major League Baseball should look at, because unknowingly they're creating an unsafe environment for, you know, LGBTQIA and people of color. And those are already two groups that don't get a lot of representation, not only, you know, in baseball, but in society as well. And I think that, you know, they need to take a good look at their fan base and see that a lot of these people will not go to games because they feel unsafe and they will just watch it from home instead. And it, you know, again, it just sets a bad precedent, you know, instead of like actually trying to make everyone feel safe in the ballpark, as opposed to trying to make a PR nightmare go away.
And this is more the media, I guess, than, you know, baseball itself. But I think a way that we have seen that there's been an attempt, albeit a very misguided one, to, you know, reach out to people who are most directly affected by haters' tweets is by going up and asking, you know, random ball players of color and specifically black ball players, their reactions to it. And that's just, it's something that has been called out many times. Jamal Collier, the Nats beat writer for MLB, had some really good tweets about that today. He said, you know, it's not these players' burden to answer for other people's racist, sexist, homophobic tweets. And it's not. But at the same time, what are these players supposed to say? You know, especially if they're haters' teammates, what are they supposed to say besides, oh, we support him and we forgive him? It's again, I think people may have good intentions when they're, you know, going up to them and trying to get their voices into the discussion, but that's not really what happens, because we know that we're not really getting, in many cases, the authentic feelings on the subject matter, because there's not really much of a choice in what you could say, because you're very limited by, I guess, locker room culture and the sort of response that you're going to get. So that's been another thing that's been frustrating about this whole ordeal, that's a way that we've seen that there's been an attempt to reckon with the fallout of haters' tweets, but it's not the way to go about it.
Yeah, there just seems to be a lot of wanting to turn this into some sort of feel-good redemption story when there has been no evidence that Hader does not uphold the same views today that he tweeted when he was 17 and 18.
But Mary, he cried.
Oh, right. Oh, I'm so sorry for forgetting about that. Of course, he's fully reformed. And he, I'm sure, now does a lot for marginalized communities. So my apologies to Josh Hader for glossing over his white male tears.
The real victim.
Yeah, he's you know, had a lot of punishments come his way, amounting to precisely nothing and receiving a standing ovation. So, you know, there's I feel for him in this situation. And then there's just a lack of critical thought on behalf of, you know, predominantly, you know, white male writers in terms of what these situations mean to players of color, mean to fans of color. And it just seems like, you know, we saw it with a Hader's press conference for the Milwaukee Brewers when all of the players of color on the team were lined up behind him and were giving him the stink eye. And then, you know, he was just kind of surrounded by white men reporters asking him the most basic questions possible and not pushing him further. So that was not great to see, because then we get stories about how, you know, he you know, made a heartfelt apology, as opposed to people looking at his words and seeing that he didn't actually apologize for anything. He did not address specifically any of the marginalized communities that he harmed. He did not give evidence to why and how he no longer has those bigoted views. And we're just kind of missing all of that analysis. And a lot of beat writers, you know, several names that we have mentioned already, are, you know, doing their best to fill those gaps. But there's a real, you know, lacking of that on the national level.
And also, I highly doubt that they're listening to this, but I will just say, Major League Baseball, if you would like, I do teach a gender and sexual identity workshop. So if you need someone to actually educate players, please at me on Twitter.
Hard to say no to that offer. this was not the only controversy that came about because of the All-Star Game. Admittedly, this one is of a much lesser nature, but nonetheless caused a bit of a stir. Commissioner Rob Manfred essentially blamed Mike Trout for MLB's struggles with marketing its players. He asserted prior to the All-Star Game, quote, "You cannot market a player passively. You can't market anything passively. You need people to engage with those to whom you are trying to market in order to have effective marketing. We are very interested in having our players more engaged and having higher profile players and helping our players develop their individual brand. But that involves that player being actively engaged." And this was all specifically in reference to Mike Trout. So in response, the Angels released a statement on Wednesday applauding Trout for, quote, "prioritizing his personal values over commercial self-promotion," unquote, and arguing that Trout does quite a bit in terms of marketing for the Angels. Later that day, the Angels released a statement from Trout saying, "I have received a lot of questions from about Commissioner Manfred's recent statements. I am not a petty guy and would really encourage everyone to just move forward. Everything is cool between the commissioner and myself. End of story. I am ready to just play some baseball," which that's a very Mike Trout statement right there.
With an exclamation yes. point at the end. That's the important part.
He's ready to just play some baseball. The Mike Trout story. So, who is responsible for MLB's struggles with marketing its players?
I mean, obviously, Major League Baseball itself, they just seem to have a narrow idea of what marketing a baseball player means. They seem really concentrated on having Mike Trout as the singular face of baseball. And they want him to have, you know, more quote-unquote personality than he appears to have, while neglecting all of the things that he has done for the Angels, and the fact that there are fans who will flock to him because he is boring, because he loves the weather, and that they're just, you know, not accentuating the things about Trout that they need to accentuate, while also saying that he's like boring and people therefore shouldn't pay attention to him. So it's all just like very bizarre and backwards and off-putting the way that they've approached this. And they've also just neglected so many other players who would be so much more willing than Trout to be, you know, one of the faces of baseball, particularly a lot of those players were kind of given the spotlight during the All-Star festivities. And we saw that they have fun and love the game and, you know, love talking about it, love joking around about it. But it just seems unlikely that Major League Baseball is actually going to build on that momentum, which is a real shame.
Yeah, I feel like MLB seems to be determined to blame its marketing struggles on everyone but its own marketing team. And I feel like there are so many different ways that they can market players, and they have done a better job with, like, social media and Cut Four and being a lot more fun about things, but that's not reflected throughout all of baseball. And I feel like MLB just needs to loosen up and actually have fun and, you know, embrace that Mike Trout could seem boring to some people, but let's not forget that, you know, he makes Space Jam references in the dugout and loves the weather so much. And
his whole
also
family
his
loves
entire
the weather. That's what we found out this week, which is amazing.
That's fantastic. And also, like, his whole thing with, like, the Eagles and the fact that he, you know, his passion is not displayed as, like, as fervently as some other players, but it's there. And I think Major League Baseball needs to accept that players' personalities don't fit a mold. They can't will players to be a certain way, because that's never going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think if you are a baseball player, your job is to put on the best performance that you can and to then let the powers that be market that performance. And Mike Trout has more than done his share of that deal. He is, you know, a generational talent. He has done nothing but be consistently incredible since coming up. And that it seems like that should be a thing that you can work with, but apparently that's a struggle because he endorses pretzels and that's it. Like, I don't quite get it, but I don't know. It's just kind of amazing to me because you look at the past, and I get that things have changed with how marketing works and such, but like, think about it. Like, if Lou Gehrig was playing today, like, people would say he was boring. Like, people would say he was hard to market. And it's just like, okay, that clearly wasn't always the case. He was one of the game's biggest stars. So, you know, why is Trout, like, why are we having issues with Trout? I don't get it. I mean, I get it, but, like, I don't get it. It just seems like, I don't know, it's kind of tacky to, like, put it out there that it is a specific person's problem. And again, there's so many big personalities in the game. Trout's not the only, like, with baseball, it's so much more of an ensemble game than, you know, most of the other big professional sports. Like, you know, obviously with basketball, you can have one guy sort of carrying a team, and, you know, it's understandable that it's easier to single out big names there. But with baseball, it's like, you, the beauty of it is, you know, it is so ensemble focused, and you do have so many people making impacts. So there's no reason that you can't have multiple faces of baseball. I think that that view of the game is kind of outdated in and of itself. So yeah, there should be a push, I guess, to focus on some of the other characters in the game and to realize that there's a lot of star potential out there, and it's not limited to Trout. If, you know, it's an impossible task to market him. There's a number of things wrong with all that. But I think what it really comes down to is the fact that it doesn't start and end with Trout. And also, Trout has done his share of the job, so it's not really fair to put any sort of blame on him.
So moving on from All-Star Game and marketing and things, as you likely know, the Manny Machado saga is finally over. He was traded on Wednesday to the Dodgers, with the Orioles in turn receiving five players: outfielder Yusniel Diaz, right-hander Dean Kremer, third baseman Rylan Bannon, right-hander Zach Pop, and third baseman Breivik Valera. So what makes the Dodgers the ideal team for Machado?
Well, for one thing, they are almost definitely playoff bound, barring some sort of massive collapse, knock on wood. So they obviously have a need for him. They have had some issues on the left side of the infield this year. Justin Turner was hurt to start the year, and he has not fully rounded back into form yet. You know, obviously, they lost Corey Seager for the season, so you know they've kind of been using a stopgap approach at shortstop, and this allows them to not really do that now. They just have a guy there that they can plug in and they know is going to hit for them consistently. So that is, those are kind of the big reasons why they're an ideal match for him. They had a need, and he suited it, and they had the prospects and the money to handle it. So.
Yeah, it seems like it's a good fit for all of those reasons for Machado, and it seems like, additionally, the Dodgers are a fairly fun team, and Machado's a fun player, so he should have no problem kind of fitting fitting into the clubhouse there as well.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, Sarah. Like, they needed help in that side of the infield, and Manny Machado is available. The only other comment I have is Rylan Bannon's name will always be hard for me to say, because I always wanted to say like Ryan Banlin or something like that and just like mix up letters. But, you know, that's a personal problem. So did the Orioles receive any sure thing prospects in the trade?
I'd say the closest to that is Yusniel Diaz. He was the one who was headlining the package of prospects, and he's, you know, one of the higher ranked prospects in the Dodgers organization. He was in the top 100 prospects for MLB Pipeline, just in baseball overall. And he's definitely got the talent and the skill to go all the way and make it as a successful major leaguer. So he's the one that is, I think, most likely to be someone that the Dodgers miss. But he also, you know, being an outfielder, he really comes from a position of strength for them and a position of depth for them. So it's not like it's going to really hurt them long term losing his services. But yeah, I think he's probably the one who's most likely to pan out. That said, I'm very sad to see Dean Kremer go. He's the first ever he's Israeli born, but he has Israeli citizenship, and he's the first ever person with Israeli citizenship to be drafted by a major league team. So I'm like, we could have had a Dodger who spoke Hebrew. That would have been so gnarly. But that is also a personal thing. So less about him being a sure thing and more about me wanting to cheer for any Jewish ball player.
Yeah, I think he was born in Stockton, but has Israeli citizenship through his
parents. That sounds right.
But also, I will say that he has, like, very sick secondary pitches, and his fastball is just like, poof. When I saw him at the All-Star game in Lancaster for the Cal League, he was very impressive. He had stuff. It wasn't, like, overpowering stuff, but, like, it was more the way that he was able to command it and locate it and fool a lot of hitters. It was... He stood out to me in that regard.
Yeah, and it sounds like he's really kind of been rounding into form nicely this season. So he could, I mean, he's probably someone who's going to make it at some point, maybe not, you know, be a superstar pitcher or anything like that, but certainly serviceable. So I'm still rooting for you, Dean Kremer.
So where do we think Machado might end up in free agency?
Not the Yankees. Please not the Yankees.
It could be the Yankees, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I feel like he will follow Jonathan Scope wherever Scope is.
Oh, so sad.
That was heartbreaking.
It still makes me so sad. For those who don't know, he literally left his vacation to tell Machado goodbye in person. I believe there's another story somewhere where it was like Machado's birthday, and it was like a birthday cake and candles, and he told Scope to blow out the candle and wish that Machado won't get traded. This is the part of baseball that I hate the most. So
these guys, they just want to stay with their friends, and sometimes it just doesn't work that way. It's like, I don't know, one of those like sad movies you had to watch as a kid where like you just want to, I don't know, be with your dog forever, and you can't always be with your dog, and I don't know what I'm saying, but it's really sad is what I'm getting at.
It is. Free agent season, or free agent trade deadline season is always sad for you know, all of the friends that are kind of ripped away from each other. And I know everybody kind of loves the whole notion of dugout hugs, you know, but it's heartbreaking stuff as well.
They're hugging because they're sad that their teammate is leaving. It's their buddy, and it's
yeah. So in other trade news, Cleveland traded outfielder Francisco Mejia to the Padres in return for Brad Hand and Adam Simber. The Mets traded Jeurys Familia to the A's for outfielder William Toffey and right-hander Bobby Wall, plus international slot money. And there will doubtlessly be many more moves coming in the next week, as we are just 9 days away from the non-waiver deadline.
So that'll be an exciting and stressful thing to be keeping an eye on, and we'll talk about a whole bunch of other moves this next week, I'm sure.
It was so weird that, like, when all the Familia stuff came up, I was in the press box for the A's high A affiliate, Stockton, where Will Toffey was playing that night, and like I was looking for like the dugout hugs, and I was like, okay, is anyone on this team going? And then like they announced it the next morning, and I was like, all right, well, at least they didn't do it in the middle of the game, because that just would have been extremely sad.
So, yeah.
Just an aside.
Yeah, it's like, you know, obviously we talk a lot about the major league side of this stuff, but I think we maybe don't think quite as much about the minor leaguers and what it does for their lives and their teams that they play on. I think we see minor league teams as a lot more transitory, because obviously players stick around there for much shorter amounts of time usually. But nonetheless, it's still very real, the bonds that they form and have to sometimes break. So that's another thing that goes into all this trade deadline madness. All right, and now for this week in baseball history. There were some memorable Hall of Fame inductions. On July 23rd, 1962, Jackie Robinson became the first black player inducted into the Hall of Fame. On July 24th, 1956, Hank Greenberg became the first Jewish player inducted into the Hall of Fame. And to this day, there's, I would say, 2.5 Jewish players in the Hall of Fame. It's obviously Sandy Koufax, and then there's Lou Boudreau, who had a Jewish mother but was raised Catholic, so, you know, kind of a unclear ground there, so we'll go with 2.5.
July 25th, 1955, Joe DiMaggio is elected to the Hall of Fame in his third year on the ballot. And then in July 26, 1998, Larry Doby is elected. And furthermore, in this week in baseball history, July 19, 1909, Cleveland shortstop Neil Ball pulled off the first unassisted triple play in modern major league history.
He has a great last name to play baseball, by the way.
He does. That is such a baseball.
It seems like he should have been a pitcher, though, because it generally tends to be pitchers that have the, you know, the most fitting names and in kind of the worst ways.
Ball four.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Homer Bailey.
Grand ball four.
Grand ball four.
The entire thing is perfect.
Of course, there's also Josh Altman.
Yeah, that's good.
I just, so to, because they're, you know, Balfour was once with the A's and so was Outman. I just remember Dallas Braden saying, he just gets the outs, man. And I was like, why? And then Grant Balfour, I remember I used to heckle him when he was not on the A's and I'd say, hey, Balfour, Grant Balfour. And I was amused with myself as a dumb 19-year-old. So
see, those are the kinds of dumb things it's acceptable to say as a teenager.
Yeah.
Take note, everyone.
You can make as many bad puns as you want, but don't go into bigotry. There's a line for you. And to close out this week in baseball history, there's one moment near and dear to my heart. On July 24th, 2004, the Red Sox and the Yankees had a massive brawl. That was an actual brawl as opposed to, you know, a benches clearing and then people just kind of like mill around for 10 minutes before running back out to the bullpens. And this is the one that many believe propelled the Red Sox to a strong second half finish and then to a World Series victory. So it is great. It is the one brawl that I will forever love, despite the fact that brawls are bad.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times audio. You can find the Hardball Times at fangraphs.com/THT and on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at Jen Mac Ramos. You can find Sarah at SarahWexler32. You can find Mary at Mary M. Craig, and you can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times audio on iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.